go. He thinks he took us at random, like a little kid in a supermarket just pulling any can that catches his eye off the shelf and dropping it into his mom's cart, but that's not what happened. It's like the angel of death in Egypt, isn't it? Cynthia said in a curiously flat voice. Only in reverse. We had a mark on us that told our angel of death, this guy in Trajan, to stop and grab instead of just going on by. David nodded. Yeah, he didn't know it then, but he does now. Mi hemen to, he'd say. Our God is strong. Our God is with us. If this is an example of God being with us, I hope I never attract his attention when he's in a snit, Johnny said. Now Tack wants us to go, David said, and he knows that we can go, because of the free will covenant. That's what Reverend Martin always called it. He... David? Ralph asked. What is it? What's wrong? David shrugged. Nothing. It doesn't matter. What matters is that God never makes us do what he wants us to do. He tells us, that's all, then steps back to see how it turns out. Reverend Martin's wife came in and listened for a while he was talking about the free will covenant. She said her mother had a motto. God says, take what you want and pay for it. Tax opened the door back to Highway 50, but that isn't where we're supposed to go. If we do go, if we leave desperation without doing what God sent us here to do, we'll pay the price. He glanced at the circle of faces around him once again, and once again he finished by looking directly at Johnny Merrinville. I'll stay no matter what, but to work, it really has to be all of us. We have to give our will over to God's will, and we have to be ready to die, because that's what it might come to. You're insane, my boy, Johnny said. Ordinarily, I like that in a person, but this is going a little too far, even for me. I haven't survived this long in order to be shot or pecked to death by buzzards in the desert. As for God, as far as I'm concerned, he died in the DMZ back in 1969. Jimi Hendrix was playing Purple Haze on Armed Services Radio at the time. Listen to the rest, okay? Will you do that much? Why should I? Because there's a story. David drank more Jolt, grimacing as he swallowed. A good one. Will you listen? Story hour's over. I told you that. David didn't reply. There was silence in the back of the truck. Steve was watching Johnny closely. If he showed any sign of moving toward the rider's back door and trying to run it up, Steve meant to grab him. He didn't want to. He'd spent a lot of years in the savagely hierarchical world of backstage rock and knew that doing such a thing would make him feel like Fletcher Christian to Johnny's Captain Bly. But he would if he had to. So it was a relief when Johnny shrugged, smiled, hunkered down next to the kid and selected his own bottle of Jolt. Okay, so story hour's extended, just for tonight. He ruffled David's hair. The very self-consciousness of the gesture made it oddly charming. Stories have been my Achilles heel practically since I ditched the stroller. I have to tell you, though, this is one I'd like to hear end with, and they lived happily ever after. Wouldn't we all, Cynthia said. I think the guy I met told me everything, David said, but there are still some parts I don't know, parts that are blurry or just plain black, maybe because I couldn't understand or because I didn't want to. Do the best you can, Ralph said. That'll be good enough. David looked up into the shadows, thinking, summoning, Cynthia thought, and then began. 3. Billingsley told the legend, and like most legends, I guess most of it was wrong. It wasn't a cave-in that closed the China shaft, that's the first thing. The mine was brought down on purpose, and it didn't happen in 1858, although that was when the first Chinese miners were brought in, but in September of 1859. Not 40 Chinese down there when it happened, but 57. Not 2 white men, but 4. 61 people in all. and the drift wasn't 150 feet deep, like Billingsley said, but nearly 200. Can you imagine? 200 feet deep in Hornfels that could have fallen in on them at any moment. The boy closed his eyes. He looked incredibly fragile, like a child who has just begun to recover from some terrible illness and may relapse at any moment. Some of that look might have been caused by the thin green sheen of soap still on his skin, but Cynthia didn't think that was all of it. Nor did she doubt David's power, or have a problem with the idea that he might have been touched by God. She had been raised in a parsonage, and she had seen this look before, although never so strongly. At 1:10 on the afternoon of September 21st, the guys at the face broke through into what they at first thought was a cave. Inside the opening was a pile of those stone things, thousands of them, statues of certain animals, low animals, the Timosen Ka. Wolves, coyotes, snakes, spiders, rats, bats. The miners were amazed by these and did the most natural thing in the world, bent over and picked some up. Bad idea, Cynthia murmured. David nodded. Some went crazy at once, turning on their friends, heck, turning on their relatives, and trying to rip their throats out. Others, not just the ones farther back in the shaft who didn't actually handle the cantas, but some who were close and actually did handle them, seemed all right, at least for a while. Two of these were brothers from Tsingtao, Chan Lushan and Xie Lushan. Both saw through the break in the face and into the cave, which was really kind of an underground chamber. It was round, like the bottom of a well. The walls were made of faces, these stone animal faces. The faces of the Kantaks, I think, although I'm not sure about that. There was a small kind of building to one side, the Pirin Mo. I don't know what that means, I'm sorry. And in the middle, a round hole 12 feet across, like a giant eye or another well, a well in a well, like the carvings, which are mostly animals with other animals in their mouths for tongues. Kantak in Kanta, Kanta in Kantak. Or camera in camera, Marinville said. He spoke with an eyebrow raised, his sign that he was making fun, but David took him seriously. He nodded and began to shiver. That's Tak's place, he said. The Inni, well of the worlds. I don't understand you, Steve said gently. David ignored him. It was still Marinville he seemed to mostly be talking to. The force of evil from the Inni filled the cantas the same way the minerals fill the ground itself, blown into every particle of it, like smoke, and it filled the chamber I'm talking about the same way. It's not smoke, but smoke is the best way to think about it, maybe. It affected the miners at different rates, like a disease germ. The ones who went nuts right away turned on the others. Some, their bodies started to change the way Audrey's did at the end. Those were the ones who touched the cantas, sometimes picked up whole handfuls at once, and then put them down so they could, you know, go at the others. Some of them were widening the hole between the shaft and the chamber. Others were wriggling through. Some acted drunk. Others acted as if they were having convulsions. Some ran across to the pit and threw themselves into it, laughing. The Lushan brothers saw a man and a woman fucking each other. I have to use that word. It was the furthest thing in the world from making love. With one of the statues held between them, in their teeth. Cynthia exchanged a startled look with Steve. In the shaft itself, the miners were bashing each other with rocks or pulling each other out of the way, trying to get through the hole first. He looked around at them somberly. I saw that part. In a way, it was funny, like a Three Stooges show. And that made it worse, that it was funny. Do you get it? Yes, Marinville said. I get it very well, David. Go on. The brothers felt it all around them, the stuff that was coming out of the chamber, but not as anything that was inside them, not then. One of the cantas had fallen at Chan's feet, He bent to pick it up, and she pulled him away. By then, they were about the only ones left who seemed sane. Most of the others who weren't affected right away had been killed, and there was a thing like a snake made of smoke coming out of the hole. It made a squealing sound, and the brothers ran from it. One of the white men was coming down the crosscut about 60 feet up, and he had his gun out. "What's all the commotion about, Chinkies?" he asked. Cynthia felt her skin chill. She reached out for Steve and was relieved when his fingers folded over hers. The boy hadn't just imitated a gruff boss man's tone. He seemed actually to be speaking in the voice of someone else. "Come on now, fellows, getty-backy-worky if you don't want a bullet in the guts." But he was the one who got shot. Chan grabbed him around the neck, and Shi took away his gun. He put the barrel here. David poked his forefinger up under the shelf of his jaw and blew the guy's head off. "David, do you know what they were thinking when they did that?" Marinville asked. "Was your dream friend able to take you in that far?" "Mostly I just saw." "Those Kantar things must have gotten to them after all," Ralph said. "They wouldn't have shot a white man otherwise, no matter what was going on or how bad they wanted to get away." "Maybe so," David said. "But God was in them too, I think, the way he's in us now. God could move them to his work, no matter if they were me and tak or not, because me hem and toe, our God is strong. Do you understand?" "I think I do," Cynthia said. "What happened then, David?" The brothers ran up the shaft, pointing the foreman's pistol at anyone who tried to hold them back or slow them down. There weren't many. Even the other white guys hardly gave them a glance when they ran by. They all wanted to see what was going on, what the miners had found. It drew them, you see. You do see, don't you? The others nodded. About 60 feet in from the adit, the Lushan brothers stopped and went to work on the hanging wall. They didn't talk about it. They saw picks and shovels and just went to work. "What's a hanging wall?" Steve asked. "The roof of a mine shaft and the earth above it," Marinville said. "They worked like madmen," David went on. "The stuff was so loose that it started falling out of the ceiling right away, but the ceiling didn't give way. The screams and howls and laughter coming up from below. I know the words for the sounds I heard, but I can't describe how horrible they were. Some of them were changing from human to something else. There was a movie I saw one time about this doctor on a tropical island who was changing animals into men." Marinville nodded. "The island of Dr. Moreau." David said, "The sounds I heard from the bottom of the mine, the ones I heard with the Lushan brothers' ears, were like that movie, only in reverse. As if the men were turning into animals." "I guess they were. I guess that's sort of what the Kantars do. What they're for." "The brothers, I see them. Two Chinese men who look almost enough alike to be twins, with pigtails hanging down their sweaty, bare backs, standing there and looking up and chopping away at the hanging wall that should have come down after about 6 licks, but didn't. Looking back along the shaft every 2 or 3 strokes to see who was coming. To see what was coming. Pieces of the ceiling fell in front of them in big chunks. Sometimes pieces of it fell on them, too. And pretty soon their shoulders were bleeding, and their heads. Blood was streaming down their faces and necks and chests as well. By then, there were other sounds from below. Things roaring. Things squelching, and still the roof wouldn't come down. Then they started seeing lights farther down, maybe candles, maybe the seniors the crew bosses wore." "What?" Ralph began. "Keroseners. They were like these little lighted boxes of oil you put on your forehead with a strip of rawhide. You'd fold a piece of cloth underneath to keep your skin from getting too hot. And then someone came running out of the darkness, someone they knew. It was Yuan Ti. He was a funny guy, I guess. He made animals out of pieces of cloth and then put on shows with them for the kids. Yuan Ti had gone crazy, but that wasn't all. He was bigger, so big he had to bend almost double in order to run up the shaft. He was throwing rocks at them, calling them names in Mandarin, condemning their ancestors, commanding them to stop what they were doing. Xie shot him with the foreman's gun. He had to shoot him a lot before Yuan Ti would lie down and be dead. But the others were coming, screaming for their blood. Tak knew what they were doing, you see. David looked at them, seemed to consider them. His eyes were dreamy, half in a trance, but Cynthia had no sense that the boy had ceased to see them. In a way, that was the most terrible part of what was happening here. David saw them very well. And so did the force inside him, the one she could sometimes hear stepping forward to clarify parts of the story David might not have fully understood. Xie and Chan went back to work on the hanging wall, digging into it with their picks like madmen, which they'd be before it was over for them. By then, the part of the ceiling they were working on was like a dome over their heads. David made curving gestures with his hands, and Cynthia saw that his fingers were trembling. And they couldn't reach it very well with their picks anymore. So Xie, the older, got on his younger brother's shoulders and dug into it that way. The stuff fell out in showers. There was a pile almost as high as Chan Lushan's knees in front of them, and still the ceiling wouldn't come down. "Were they possessed of God, David?" Marinville asked. There was no sarcasm in his voice now. "Possessed by God? What do you think?" "I don't think so," David said. "I don't think God has to possess. That's what makes him God. I think they wanted what God wanted, to keep Tak in the earth, to bring the ceiling down between them and it, if they could. Anyway, they saw Seeners coming up from the mine, heard people yelling, a whole mob of them. Xie left off on the hang wall and went to work on one of the crossbar supports instead, hitting it with the butt of his pick. The miners coming up from below threw rocks at them, and quite a few hit Chan, but he stood firm with his brother on his shoulders. When the crossbar finally came down, the ceiling came down with it. Chan was buried up to his knees, but Xie was thrown clear. He pulled his brother out. Chan was badly bruised, but nothing was broken. And they were on the right side of the rockfall. That must have seemed like the important thing. They could hear the miners, their friends, cousins, and in the case of Chan Lushan, his intended wife, screaming to be let out. Chan actually started to pull some of the rocks away before Xie yanked him back and reasoned with him. They still could reason then, you see. Then, as if the people trapped on Tak's side of the fall knew this had happened, the screams for help changed to yelling and howling, the sounds of, well, of people who weren't really people at all anymore. Chan and Xie ran. They met folks, some white, some Chinese, coming in as they ran out. No questions were asked except for the most obvious one, what happened, and since the answer was just as obvious, they had no trouble. There'd been a cave-in, men were trapped, and the last thing anyone cared about just then were a couple of scared China boys who happened to get out in the nick of time. David drank the last of his soda and set the empty bottle aside. "Everything Mr. Billingsley told us is like that," he said. "Truth and mistakes and outright lies all mixed up." "The technical term for it is legend-making," Marinville said with a thin, strained smile. The miners and the folks from town could hear the Chinese screaming behind the fallen hanging wall, but they didn't just stand around. They did try to dig them out, and they did try to shore up the first 60 feet or so. But then there was another fall, a smaller one, and another couple of crossbars snapped. So they pulled back and waited for the experts to show up from Reno. There was no picnic outside the adit. That's a flat lie. Right around the time the mining engineers were getting off the stage in desperation, there were two cave-ins, real cave-ins, big ones, at the mine. The first was on the added side of the hanging wall the Lushan brothers had pulled down. It sealed off the last 60 feet of the drift like a cork in a bottle. And the thump it made coming down, tons and tons of scarn and hornfels, set off another one, deeper in. That ended the screams, at least the ones close enough to the surface for people to hear. It was all over before the mining engineers got up from town in an ore wagon. They looked, they sank some core rods, they listened to the story, and when they heard about the second cave-in, which people said shook the ground like an earthquake and made the horses rear up, they shook their heads and said there was probably nobody left alive to rescue. And even if there was, they'd be risking more lives than they could hope to save if they tried to go back in. "And they were only Chinese," Steve said.
"That's right. Little chink-chink China boys."
Mr. Billingsley was right about that. And while all this was going on, the two China boys who had escaped were out in the desert near Rose Rock going mad. It got to them in the end, you see. It caught up with them. It was almost 2 weeks before they came back to Desperation, not 3 days. It was the Lady Day they walked into. You see how we got the truth all mixed up with the lies? But they didn't kill anyone there. Shea flashed the foreman's gun, which was empty, and that was all it took. They were brought down by a whole pack of miners and cowboys. They were naked except for loincloths. They were covered with blood. The men in the Lady Day felt like that blood must have been from all the folks they had murdered, but it wasn't. They'd been out in the desert, calling animals to them, just like Tack called the cougar that you shot, Mr. Marinville. Only the Lushan brothers didn't want them for anything like that. They only wanted to eat. They ate whatever came. Bats, buzzards, spiders, rattlesnakes. David raised an unsteady hand to his face and wiped first his left eye and then his right. "I feel very sorry for the Lushan brothers, and I feel like I know them a little, how they must have felt, how they must have been grateful in a way when the madness finally took them over completely and they didn't have to think anymore. They could have stayed out there in the Desitoya foothills practically forever, I guess, but they were all Tack had, and Tack is always hungry. It sent them into town because there was nothing else it could do. One of them, Shea, was killed right there in the Lady Day. Chan was hung 2 days later, right about where those 3 bikes were turned upside down in the street. Remember those? He raved in Tack's language, the language of the unformed, right up until the end. He tore the hood right off his head, so they hung him barefaced.
"Boy, that god of yours, what a guy!" Marinville said cheerfully. "Really knows how to repay a favor, doesn't he, David?"
"God is cruel," David said in a voice almost too low to hear.
"What?" Marinville asked. "What did you say?"
"You know. But life is more than just steering a course around pain. That's something you used to know, Mr. Marinville. Didn't you?" Marinville looked off into the corner of the truck and said nothing. 4. The first thing Mary was aware of was a smell. Sweetish, rank, nauseating. "Oh, Peter, damn it to hell," she thought groggily. "It's the freezer. Everything's spoiled." Except that wasn't right. The freezer had gone off during their trip to Mallorca, and that had happened a long time ago, before the miscarriage. A lot had happened since then. A lot had happened just recently, in fact. Most of it bad. But what? Central Nevada's full of intense people. Who said that? Marielle? In her head, it certainly sounded like Marielle. Doesn't matter if it's true. And it is, isn't it? She didn't know. Didn't want to know. What she mostly wanted was to go back into the darkness part of her was trying to come out of, because there were voices.
They're a dastardly bunch.
And sounds. Reek, reek, reek. That she didn't want to consider. Better to just lie here and... Something scuttered across her face.
It felt both light and hairy. She sat up, pawing her cheeks with both hands. An enormous bolt of pain went through her head. Bright dots flashed across her vision in sync with her suddenly elevated heart rate, and she had a similarly bright flash of recall, one even Johnny Marinville would have admired. I bumped my bad arm, putting up another crate to stand on. "Hold on, you'll be inside in a jiffy." And then she had been grabbed. By Ellen. No. By the thing, Tack, that had been wearing Ellen. That thing had slugged her, and then, boom, boom, out go the lights. And in a very literal sense, they were still out. She had to flutter her lids several times simply to assure herself that her eyes were open. Oh, they're open, all right. Maybe it's just dark in this place. But maybe you're blind. How about that for a lovely thought, Mare? Maybe she hit you hard enough to blind you. Something was on the back of her hand. It ran halfway across and then paused, seeming to throb on her skin. Mary made a sound of revulsion with her tongue pressed to the roof of her mouth and flapped her hand madly in the air like a woman waving off some annoying person. The throbbing disappeared. The thing on the back of her hand was gone. Mary got to her feet, provoking another cymbal crash of pain in her head, which she barely noticed. There were things in here, and she had no time for a mere headache. She turned slowly around, breathing that sickish sweet aroma that was so similar to the stench that had greeted her and Pete when they had returned home from their mini-vacation to the Balearic Islands. Pete's parents had given them the trip as a Christmas present the year after they had been married, and how great it had been, until they had walked back in, bags in hand, and the stench had hit them like a fist. They had lost everything. 2 chickens, the chops and roasts she'd gotten at the good discount meat cutters she'd found in Brooklyn, the venison steaks Peter's friend Don had given them, the pints of strawberries they'd picked at Mohonk Mountain House the previous summer. This smell, so similar. Something that felt the size of a walnut dropped into her hair. She screamed, at first beating at it with the flat of her hand. That did no good, so she slid her fingers into her hair and got hold of whatever it was. It squirmed, then burst between her fingers. Thick fluid squirted into her palm. She raked the bristly, deflating body out of her hair and shook it off her palm. She heard it hit something. Splat! Her palm felt hot and itchy, as if she had reached into poison ivy. She rubbed it against her jeans. "Please, God, don't let me be next," she thought. "Whatever happens, don't let me end up like the cop, like Ellen." She fought the urge to simply bolt into the black surrounding her. If she did that, she might brain herself, disembowel herself, or impale herself, like an expendable character in a horror movie, on some grotesque piece of mining equipment. But even that wasn't the worst. The worst was that there might be something besides the scuttering things in here with her, something that was just waiting for her to panic and run, waiting with its arms held out. Now she had a sense. Perhaps it was only her imagination, but she didn't think so. Of stealthy movement all around her. A rustling sound from the left. A slithering from the right. There was a sudden low squalling from behind her, there and gone before she could scream. "That last one wasn't anything alive," she told herself. "At least I don't think so. I think it was a tumbleweed hitting metal and scraping along it. I think I'm in a little building somewhere. She put me in a little building for safekeeping, and the fridge is out, just like the lights, and the stuff inside is spoiled." But if Ellen was in Trajan in a new body, why hadn't he/she just put her back in the cell where he'd put her to start with? Because he/she was afraid the others would find her there and let her out again? It was as plausible a reason as any other she could think up, and there was a thread of hope in it as well. Holding on to it, Mary began to shuffle slowly forward with her hands held out. It seemed she walked that way for a very long time, years. She kept expecting something else to touch her, and at last something did. It ran across her shoe. Mary froze. Finally, it went about its business. But what followed was even worse. A low, dry rattle coming out of the darkness at roughly 10 o'clock. So far as she knew, there was only one thing that rattled like that. The sound didn't really stop, but seemed to die away, like the whine of a cicada on a hot August afternoon. The low squalling returned. This time she was positive it was a tumbleweed sliding along metal. She was in a mining building, maybe the Quonset, where Steve and the girl with the wild hair, Cynthia, had seen the little stone statue that had frightened them so badly. Get moving. I can't. There's a rattlesnake in here. Maybe more than one. Probably more than one. That's not all that's in here, though. Better get moving, Mary. Her palm throbbed angrily where the thing in her hair had burst open. Her heart thudded in her ears. As slowly as she could, she began inching forward again, hands out. Terrible ideas and images went with her. She saw a snake as thick as a power line dangling from a rafter just ahead of her, fang jaws hinged wide, forked tongue dancing. She would walk right into it and wouldn't know until it battened on her face, injecting its poison straight into her eyes. She saw the closet demon of her childhood, a bogey she had for some reason called Apple Jack, slumped in the corner with his brown fruit face all pulled in on itself, grinning, waiting for her to wander into his deadly embrace. The last thing she'd smell would be his cidery aroma, which was for the time being masked by the stench of spoilage, as he hugged her to death, all the time covering her face with wet, avid uncle kisses. She saw a cougar, like the one that had killed poor old Tom Billingsley, crouched in a corner with its tail switching. She saw Ellen, holding a baling hook in one hand and smiling a thin, waiting smile which was like a hook itself, simply marking time until Mary got close enough to skewer. But mostly what she saw was snakes. Rattlers. Her fingers touched something. She gasped and almost recoiled, but that was just nerves. The thing was hard, unliving. A straight edge at the height of her torso. A table? Covered with an oilcloth? She thought so. She walked her fingers across it and forced herself to freeze when one of the scuttery things touched her. It crawled over the back of her hand and down to her wrist, almost surely a spider of some sort, and then was gone. She walked her hand on, and here was something else investigating her, more of what Audrey had called wildlife. Not a spider. This thing, whatever it was, had claws and a hard surface. Mary forced herself to hold still, but couldn't keep entirely quiet. A low, desperate moan escaped her. Sweat ran down her forehead and cheeks like warm motor oil, stung in her eyes. Then the thing on her hand gave her an obscene little squeeze and was gone. She could hear it click dragging its way across the table. She moved her hand again, resisting the clamor of her mind to pull back. If she did, what then? Stand here trembling in the dark until the stealthy sounds around her drove her crazy, sent her running in panicked circles until she bashed herself unconscious again? Here was a plate, no, a bowl, with something in it. Congealed soup? Her fingers fumbled beside it and felt a spoon. Yes, soup. She felt beyond it, touched what could have been a salt or pepper shaker, then something soft and flabby. She suddenly remembered a game they had played at slumber parties when she was a girl in Mamaroneck. A game made to be played in the dark. You'd pass around spaghetti and intone, "These are the dead man's guts." Pass around cold jello and intone,
These are the dead man's brains.
Her hand struck something hard and cylindrical. It fell over with a rattle. She recognized it once, or hoped she did, batteries in the tube of a flashlight.
Please, God, she thought, groping for it. Please, God, let it be what it feels like.
The squalling from outside came again, but she barely heard it. Her hand touched a cold piece of meat.
This is the dead man's face.
But she barely felt it. Her heart was hammering in her chest, her throat, even in her sinuses.
There. There.
Cold, smooth metal. It tried to squitter out of her grip, but she squeezed it tight.
Yes, a flashlight.
She could feel the switch lying against the web of skin between her thumb and forefinger.
Now let it work, God. Please, okay?
She pressed the switch. Light sprang out in a widening cone, and her yammering heartbeat stopped dead in her ears for a moment. Everything stopped dead. The table was long, covered with lab equipment and rock samples at one end, covered with a checked piece of tablecloth at the other. This end had been set, as for dinner, with a soup bowl, a plate, silverware, and a water glass. A large black spider had fallen into the water glass and couldn't get out. It writhed and scratched fruitlessly. The red hourglass on its belly showed in occasional flickers. Other spiders, most also black widows, preened and strutted on the table. Among them were rock scorpions, stalking back and forth like parliamentarians, their stingers furled on their backs. Sitting at the end of the table was a large, bald man in a Diablo Mining Corporation T-shirt. He had been shot in the throat at close range. The stuff in the soup bowl, the stuff she had touched with her fingers, wasn't soup, but this man's clotted blood. Mary's heart restarted itself, sending her own blood crashing up into her head like a piston, and all at once the flashlight's yellow fan of light began to look red and shimmery. She heard a high, sweet singing in her ears.
Don't you faint! Don't you dare!
The flashlight beam swung to the left. In the corner, under a poster which read, "Go ahead, ban mining, let the bastards freeze in the dark," was a roiling nest of rattlesnakes. She slid the beam along the metal wall, past congregations of spiders, and some of the black widows she saw were as big as her hand, and in the other corner were more snakes. Their daytime torpor was gone, and they writhed together, flowing through sheet bends and clove hitches and double diamonds, occasionally shaking their tails.
Don't faint, don't faint, don't faint.
She turned around with the light, and when it happened upon the other three bodies that were in here with her, she understood several things at once. The fact that she had discovered the source of the bad smell was only the least of them. The bodies at the foot of the wall were in an advanced state of decay, delirious with maggots, but they hadn't been simply dumped. They were lined up, perhaps even laid out. Their puffy, blackening hands had been laced together on their chests. The man in the middle really was black, she thought, although it was impossible to tell for sure. She didn't know him or the one on his right, but the one on the black guy's left she did know, in spite of the toiling maggots and the decomposition. In her mind, she heard him mixing, "I'm going to kill you," into the Miranda warning. As she watched, a spider ran out of Collie and Trajan's mouth. The beam of the light shook as she ran it along the line of corpses again. Three men. Three big men. Not a one of the three under 6'5".
I know why I'm here instead of in jail, she thought. And I know why I wasn't killed. I'm next. When it's through with Ellen, I'm next.
Mary began to scream. 5. The Antak chamber glowed with a faint red light that seemed to come from the air itself.
something which still looked a bit like Ellen Carver walked across it, accompanied by a retinue of scorpions and fiddlebacks. Above it, around it, the stone faces of the Cam Tacks peered down. Across from it was the pier and mall, a jutting facade that looked a bit like the front of a Mexican hacienda. In front of it was the pit, the inny, well of the worlds. The light could have been coming from here, but it was impossible to tell for sure. Sitting in a circle around the mouth of the inny were coyotes and buzzards. Every now and then, one of the birds would rustle its feathers, or one of the coyotes would flick an ear. If not for these moves, they might have been stones themselves. Ellen's body walked slowly. Ellen's head sagged. Pain pulsed deep in her belly. Blood ran down her legs in thin, steady streams. It had stuffed a torn cotton T-shirt into Ellen's panties, and that had helped for a while, but now the shirt was soaked through. Bad luck it had had, and not just once. The first one had had prostate cancer, undiagnosed, and the rot had started there, spreading through his body with such unexpected speed that it had been lucky to get to Josephson in time. Josephson had lasted a little longer, and Trajan, a nearly perfect specimen, longer still. And Ellen? Ellen had been suffering from a yeast infection. Just a yeast infection, nothing at all in the ordinary scheme of things, but it had been enough to start the dominoes falling, and now... Well, there was Mary. It didn't quite dare take her yet, not until it knew what the others were going to do. If the writer won out and took them back to the highway, it would jump to Mary and take one of the ATVs, loaded down with as many cantas as it could transport, up into the hills. It already knew where to go, Alphaville, a Vegan commune in the Desitoyas. They wouldn't be Vegans for long after Tack arrived. If the wretched little Preyboy prevailed and they came south, Mary might serve as bait or as a hostage. She would serve as neither, however, if the Preyboy sensed she was no longer human. It sat down on the edge of the inny and stared into it. The inny was shaped like a funnel, its rough walls sliding in toward each other until, 25 or 30 feet down, nothing was left of the mouth's 12-foot diameter but a hole less than an inch across. Baleful scarlet light, almost too bright to look at, stormed out of this hole in pulses. It was a hole like an eye. One of the buzzards tried to lay its head in Ellen's blood-stinking lap. It pushed the bird away. Tack had hoped looking into the inny would be calming, would help it decide what to do next, for the inny was where it really lived. Ellen Carver was just an outpost. But it only seemed to increase its disquiet. Things were on the verge of going badly wrong. Looking back, it saw clearly that some other force had perhaps been working against it from the start. It was afraid of the boy, especially in its current weakness. Most of all, it was terrified of being completely shut up beyond the narrow throat of the inny again, like a genie in a bottle. But that didn't have to be. Even if the boy brought them, it didn't have to be. The others would be weakened by their doubts. The boy would be weakened by his human concerns, especially his concern for his mother. And if the boy died, it could close the door to the outside again, close it with a bang, and then take the others. The writer and the boy's father would have to die, but the two younger ones it would try to sedate and save. Later, it might very well want to use their bodies. It rocked forward, oblivious to the blood squelching between Ellen's thighs, as it had been oblivious of the teeth falling out of Ellen's head, or the three knuckles that had exploded like pine knots in a fireplace when it had clipped Mary on the chin. It looked into the funnel of the well, at the constricted red eye at the bottom. The eye of Tack. The boy could die. He was, after all, only a boy. Not a demon, a god, or a savior.
Tack leaned farther over the funnel with its jagged crystal sides and murky reddish light. Now it could hear a sound, very faint, a kind of low, atonal humming. It was an idiot sound, but it was also wonderful, compelling. It closed its stolen eyes and breathed deeply, sucking at the force it felt, trying to get as much inside as it could, wanting to slow, at least temporarily, this body's degeneration. It would need Ellen a while longer. And besides, now it felt the innie's peace. At last.
Tack, it whispered into the darkness. Tack and to innie, tack a la, tack a wan.
Then it was silent. From below, deep in the humming red silence of the innie, came the wet tongue sound of something slithering. Chapter 2. 1. David said, "The man who showed me these things, the man who guided me, told me to tell you that none of this is destiny." His arms were clasped around his knees and his head was bent. He seemed to be speaking to his sneakers. In a way, that's the scariest part. Pye's dead, and Mr. Billingsley, and everyone else in desperation, because one man hated the Mining Safety and Health Administration, and another was too curious and hated being tied to his desk. That's all. "And God told you this?" Johnny asked. The boy nodded, still without looking up. "So we're really talking miniseries here," Johnny said. "Night one is the Lushan brothers. Night two is Josephson, the footloose receptionist. They'll love it at ABC. "Why don't you shut up?" Cynthia said softly. "Another country heard from," Johnny exclaimed. "This young woman, this road babe with attitude, this flashing female flame of commitment, will now explain, complete with pictures and taped accompaniment by the noted rock ensemble Pearl Jam."
"Just shut the fuck up," Steve said.
Johnny looked at him, shocked to silence. Steve shrugged, embarrassed but not backing down. "The time for whistling past the graveyard's over. You need to cut the crap." He looked back at David. "I know more about this part," David said. "More than I want to, actually. I got inside this one. I got inside his head." He paused. "Ripton. That was his name. He was the first." And still looking down between his cocked knees at his sneakers, David began to talk. 2. The man who hates MSHA is Carrie Ripton, pit foreman of the new rattlesnake operation. He is 48, balding, sunken-eyed, cynical, in pain more often than not these days, a man who desperately wanted to be a mining engineer but wasn't up to the math and wound up here instead, running an open pit, stuffing blast holes full of ANFO and trying not to choke the prancing little faggot from MSHA when he comes out on Tuesday afternoons. When Kirk Turner runs into the field office this afternoon, face blazing with excitement, to tell him that the last blast pattern has uncovered an old drift mine and that there are bones inside, they can see them, Ripton's first impulse is to tell him to organize a party of volunteers. They're going in. All sorts of possibilities dance in his head. He is too old a hand for childish fantasies about lost gold mines and troves of Indian artifacts. Much too old. But as he and Turner rush out, part of him is thinking about those things just the same. Oh, yes. The cluster of men standing at the foot of the newly turned blast field, eyeing the hole their latest explosions have uncovered, is a small one. 7 guys in all, counting Turner, the crew boss. There are right now fewer than 90 men working for the Desperation Mining Corporation. Next year, if they're lucky, if the copper yield and the prices both stay up, there may be 4 times that number. Ripton and Turner walk up to the edge of the hole.
There is a dank, strange smell coming out of it, one Carrie Ripton associates with coal gas in the mines of Kentucky and West Virginia. And yes, there are bones. He can see them scattering back into the canted, downsloping darkness of an old-fashioned square-drift mine, and while it's impossible to tell for sure about all of them, he sees a rib cage which is almost certainly human. Farther back, tantalizingly close, but still just a little too far, even for a powerful flashlight to show clearly, is something that could be a skull. "What is this?" Turner asks him. "Any idea?" Of course he does. It's rattlesnake number one, the old China shaft. He opens his mouth to say so, then closes it again. This is not a matter for a blast monkey like Kirk Turner, and is certainly not one for his crew, Nitro boys who spend their weekends in Ely gambling, whoring, drinking, and talking, of course. Talking about anything and everything. Nor can he take them inside. He thinks they would go, that their curiosity would drive them in spite of the obvious risks involved. A drift mine this old, running through earth this uneasy, shit, a loud yell might be enough to bring the roof down. But the talk would get back to the prancing little MSHA faggot in no time flat, and when it did, losing his job would be the least of Ripton's worries. The MSHA fag, all hat and no cattle is how Frank Geller, the chief mining engineer, sums him up, likes Ripton no more than Ripton likes him, and the foreman who leads an expedition into the long-buried China shaft today might find himself in federal court facing a $50,000 fine and a possible 5 years in jail the week after next. There are at least 9 red-letter regulations expressly forbidding entry into unsafe and unimproved structures, which this, of course, is. Yet those bones and old dreams call to him like troubled voices from his childhood, like the ghost of every unfulfilled ambition he has ever held. And he knows even then that he isn't going to turn the China shaft meekly over to the company and the federal pricks without at least one look inside for himself. He instructs Turner, who is bitterly disappointed but not really argumentative. He understands about MSHA as well as Ripton. Maybe as a blast monkey, even better. To have yellow restricted area tapes placed across the opening. He then turns to the rest of the crew and reminds them that the newly uncovered drift, which might turn out to be a historical and archaeological treasure trove, is on DMC property. "I don't expect you to keep this quiet forever," he tells them, "but as a favor to me, I'd like you to keep your mouths shut for the next few days, even with your wives. Let me notify the brass. That part should be easy, at least. Symes, the controller, is coming in from Phoenix next week. Will you do that for me?" They say they will. Not all will be able to keep their promise for even 24 hours, of course. Some men are just no good at keeping secrets. But he thinks he commands enough respect among them to buy 12 hours, and 4 would probably be enough. 4 hours after quitting time. 4 hours in there by himself, with a flashlight, a camera, and an electric follow-me for any souvenirs he may decide to collect. 4 hours with all those childhood fantasies he is too old a hand to think about. And if the roof should pick that moment, after almost 140 years and untold blasts shaking the ground all around it, to let go? Let it. He's a man with no wife, no kids, no parents, and 2 brothers who have forgotten he's alive. He has a sneaking suspicion that he wouldn't be losing that many years in any case. He's been feeling punk for almost 6 months now, and just lately he's taken to pissing blood. Not a lot, but even a little seems like a lot when it's yours you see in the toilet bowl. "If I get out of this, maybe I'll go to the doctor," he thinks. "Take it as a sign and go to the damn doctor. How about that?" Turner wants to take some pictures of the exposed drift after he clocks out. Ripton lets him. It seems the quickest way to get rid of him. "How far in do you think we punched it?" Turner asks, standing about 2 feet beyond the yellow tape and snapping pictures with his Nikon. pictures that, with no flash, will show nothing but a black hole and a few scattered bones that might belong to a deer.
No way to tell, Ripton says. In his mind, he's inventorying the equipment he'll take in with him.
You ain't gonna do nothing dumb after I'm gone, are you? Turner asks.
Nope, Ripton says. I have too much damned respect for mining safety to even think of such a thing.
Yeah, right, Turner says, laughing.
And early the next morning, around 2 o'clock, a much larger version of Carrie Ripton will enter the bedroom Turner shares with his wife and shoot the man as he sleeps. His wife, too.
Tack!
It's a busy night for Carrie Ripton. A night of killing. Not one of Turner's blast crew lives to see the morning sun. And a night of placing canned tars. He has taken a gunny sack filled with them when he leaves the pit, over 100 in all. Some have broken into pieces, but he knows even the fragments retain some of their queer, unpredictable power. He spends most of the night placing these relics, leaving them in odd corners, mailboxes, glove compartments, even in pants pockets. Yes! Hardly anyone locks their houses out here. Hardly anyone stays up late out here. And the homes belonging to Turner's blast crew are not the only ones Carrie Ripton visits. He returns to the pit, feeling as trashed out as Santa Claus returning to the North Pole after the big night. Only Santa's work ends once the presents have been distributed. Ripton's is only beginning. It's 4:45. He has over 2 hours before the first members of Pascal Martinez's small Saturday day crew show up. It should be enough, but there is certainly no time to waste. Carrie Ripton's body is bleeding so badly he's had to stuff his underwear full of toilet paper to absorb it. And twice on his way out to the mine, he has had to stop and yark a gut full of blood out the window of Carrie's pickup truck. It splashed all down the side. In the first tentative and somehow sinister light of the coming day, the drying blood looks like tobacco juice. In spite of his need to hurry, he stopped dead for a moment by what the headlights show when he arrives at the bottom of the pit. He sits behind the wheel of the old truck with his eyes wide. There are enough desert animals on the north slope of the China pit to fill an ark. Wolves, coyotes, hopping bald-headed buzzards, flapping owls with eyes like great gold wedding rings, cougars and wildcats, and even a few scruffy barn cats. There are wild dogs with their ribs arcing against their scant hides in cruel detail. Many are escapees from the raggedy-ass commune in the hills, he knows. And running around their feet unmolested are hordes of spiders and platoons of rats with black eyes. Each of the animals coming out of the China shaft carries a canteen in its mouth. They lope, flap, and scurry up the pit road like a flood of weird refugees escaping some underground world. Below them, sitting patiently like customers in a green stamp redemption center 2 days before Christmas, take a number and wait, are more animals. What they are waiting for is their turn to go into the dark. Tack begins to laugh with Carrie Ripton's vocal cords.
"What a hoot!" he exclaims.
Then he drives on to the field office, unlocks the door with Ripton's key, and kills Joe Prudham, the night watchman. Old Joe isn't much of a night watchman. Comes on at dark, doesn't have the slightest idea anything's going on in the pit, and doesn't think there's anything strange about Carrie Ripton showing up first thing in the morning. He's using the washer in the corner to do some laundry. He's sitting down to have his topsy-turvy version of dinner. And everything's cozy right up to the moment when Ripton puts a bullet in his throat. That done, Ripton calls the Owls Club in town. The Owls is open 24 hours a day, although, like a vampire, it's never really alive. It's where Brad Josephson, he of the gorgeous chocolate skin and long, sloping gut, eats breakfast 6 days a week, and always at this brutally early hour. That will come in handy now. Ripton wants Brad on hand, and quickly, before the black man can be polluted by the canned tars.
The cantas are useful in many ways, but they spoil a man or woman for tax greater work. Ripton knows he can take someone from Martinez's crew if he needs to, perhaps even Pascal himself. But he wants, well, Tack wants, actually, bread.